Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, February 25th, 2014, and I'm your host, Ariel Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Only 3 more days until Mercury goes direct. Whoopee! Well, we're all glad to hear about that. Our next Crystal Quest to Arkansas starts on Pleiadian lineup in May, and there are only 2 spots left, so if you have the required star markings on your charts and want to learn more about it, let us know quickly. Those markings are 25, 26, 27 degrees in Aquarius, Leo, Cancer, Capricorn, Taurus, and Scorpio. Just send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com for more details. Our very special guest this evening is Normandy Ellis, who's a spiritual medium, an Akashic Records consultant, and author of 10 books. Her most recent works are Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt and Imagining the World into Existence. She's spent over 20 years teaching Egyptian mysteries, leading spiritual journeys through Egypt in conjunction with shamanic journeys. One of her first books, Awakening Osiris, offers a relevant contemporary approach to the Egyptian Book of the Dead. You can check out her website at NormandyEllis.com, and that's spelled N-O-R-M-A-N-D-I, Ellis, E-L-L-I-S.com. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. We'd like to thank Fiona for hosting our switchboard this evening, and you're welcome to call in with comments or questions. The number to dial is 917-889-8292, and then press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. Wait till you're prompted for that. And if you like our show, please take a minute to click follow on our show page. We'd really appreciate your support. If you haven't visited our website, which is starseedhotline.com, make sure you take a look in the vault to find a wealth of Starseed information, plus audio and video resources. You can find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or you can also download them right from our show page archives. And we do have a forum for Starseeds at starseedhotline.ning.com, and we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their dedication to the forum. The toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you can find out how to make the most of your 10 hours of power by requesting your solar return timing. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Good evening, ladies.
Lavendar here, and I'm anxious to hear what you have to say, Anastasia, about everything tonight.
Good evening, everybody. It's so great to be back with you. I hope you all had a great week. Really hopeful. Yeah, you inspired me with your daffodil story last week. I've been looking for them here, but I haven't seen any yet. But, you know, I'm waiting to look, and I actually have some growing in the front window. Someone gave me a gift of bulbs last week. Bless their hearts, and I don't know what they are. She didn't either, whether they're tulips or daffodils or hyacinths. But I am so delighted that it's just about time, so we'll all be glad for that. I guess we're going to get some cold weather, though, in the meantime. They say we're getting another polar vortex. You know, I reported 1 month when it first started, the first polar vortex, I commented that they were not all that rare. They'd been reported before, but I'll tell you what, I don't know that we've had 3 in a year in reported history or current weather records. 3 in a year is a lot. And,
yeah.
I don't need to tell any of you listening to this that the weather is bizarre, really bizarre. England has been getting the UK has been getting so much rain, and I got to tell you something, people, those sinkholes, in the UK. I read stories about them. One of these days, I'm going to number them. I'm going to count them all up and tell you all the sinkhole stories that I've found in the last 30 to 45 days. It's staggering. And a lot of this, I don't know, they say is due to water. Some of it is due to underground pipes breaking, aging infrastructure, things like that. But, wow, it's a real problem, and it's really happening worldwide. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, so I'm going to start by talking about the sun. And there was a major solar flare. It's the returning sunspot AR1967, and this is the one that I told you was renamed 1990 on its return rotation. As it comes around to the Earth, they rename them. But it unleashed a powerful X4.9 solar flare on the 25th. And they say this is the most intense flare of 2014 so far, and one of the most intense of the current solar cycle, which, by the way, goes 11 years. Now, they say this flare is impressive. Its effects are mitigated by the location of the blast site. It happened to be near the sun's southeastern limb. It's not facing Earth. They say that there was a bright coronal mass ejection, which raced away from the sun shortly after the flare. It's going to miss our planet, thank goodness. It was traveling at 4.4 million miles per hour. They say that if such a fast-moving cloud did strike the Earth, they say that the resulting geomagnetic storms would be severe. And as a matter of fact, the Bastille event was a solar flare that was XX6. They go up as high as 8, so 4.9 isn't too far from an X6. So we could probably imagine if that struck, it would cause a lot of radio interference and probably some problems with electronics. They say, but we got lucky because the trajectory was so far off the Earth-Sun line that it will just deliver a glancing blow, if any at all. So that's good.
Yeah.
The sun has been so quiet. It's, you just never know these days what's going to happen. Everyone's been saying that the sun is so silent and nothing's been happening and what's the matter with it? Wake up, whatever. And then just kabam, you know, this happens. So we live in an age of tremendous uncertainty, which makes things interesting. I want to point out before I get into the rest of the news that I got an email from a lovely listener, Emily in Australia, and all of you have been so good to send me your emails. I wanted to tell you that I haven't been getting all of my emails. There seems to be a problem. So for those of you that I've neglected to mention, please pardon me. It's just been a problem. Some of these emails are arriving late. Sometimes I'm getting them and not getting them. So until it's too late for the news. But I wanted to thank Emily because she sent me a piece last week that I was frantically looking for before the newscast came on because it has to do with Oklahoma, and I couldn't find it, so I had to leave it out of last night's news. Well, when I got off the show, later that evening, I did find that link that she sent me, and so it's going to be in tonight's story. But I just wanted to thank Emily for sending this story about Oklahoma that you're going to hear here in a moment. Friday, on Sunday night in central New York, dozens of people across the state, say north and south or central, reported seeing a meteoroid in the sky at about 8:45 p.m. It was on Sunday, and this is according to the American Meteor Society. They say it was seen as far south as Albany and as far north as Montreal. So big fireball in the sky. There were photos of it on the Internet, pretty bright. And an astronomer has spotted an asteroid smashing into the moon. A Spanish astronomer on Monday said he had witnessed a fridge-sized asteroid smash into the moon in the biggest lunar impact by a space rock ever recorded. The flare would have been visible to the naked eye to anyone who happened to be looking at the moon at that moment under good viewing conditions. There was also a long afterglow that lasted about another 8 seconds, and this was the longest and brightest ever seen for a lunar impact. Don't drink the water in West Virginia. I haven't reported about this. I don't know that I have spoken of it at all, but I'm going to talk about it tonight. There has, as some of you may be aware, there was that horrific water spill in West Virginia, but school ended early last Monday for students at 3 elementary schools and 1 middle school in Kanawha County, West Virginia. Members of the National Guard and the State Departments of Environmental Protection and Health were called in, and it was the Rapid Response Team's third deployment to schools in the county this month. The teachers had said that the tap water smelled like licorice candy. That's the fragrance associated with MCHM, which is a coal extraction chemical that had flooded the water supply for 300,000 people in 9 West Virginia counties on January 9th. Residents of Charleston and the surrounding area live in fear of the scent, and they've grown increasingly upset. In the immediate aftermath of the contamination, 671 people called poison control, complaining of severe symptoms, and 5 days later, the local water utility declared their product safe to drink. But the safety claims have come with a caveat, because in the Charleston airport, it has been reported there is a water cooler with a note attached to it, and that is recently, and I quote, "West Virginia American Water has announced that our water meets all regulatory standards and that the water is there just for people's convenience." But there's an asterisk behind that statement, and the asterisk says, "Pregnant women and children under the age of 3 are advised not to drink our local water." Well, it remains uncertain what the long-term effects of ingesting this chemical will be on the residents of these counties, and many experts are claiming it's a scientific experiment to have people drinking this water. People are so afraid of the water that bottled water is a highly sought-after commodity. People don't trust the water. They won't drink it. They won't wash with it, and they won't let their pets or livestock near it, many people. American Water, on the other hand, has continued to bill customers at regular rates since the spill, even for pregnant households and those with small children, although they made a deduction of $10.25 for those who were advised to flush their pipes in January. Well, there has been a mysterious polio-like illness that has stricken children in California. They're calling it a polio-like syndrome, which has caused paralysis in about 20 children from across California, according to a report released Sunday by physicians in the San Francisco Bay Area. The children, who are between the ages of 3 and 12, developed what is called acute or sudden flaccid paralysis, which is weakness or loss of muscle tone resulting from injury, and that affects the nerves that stimulate the muscles to move. Now, although polio has been wiped out across most of the globe, they say that other viruses can injure the spine and cause paralysis, but it has been reported that the recent outbreak in California has left children who have been affected by this as permanently paralyzed. Now, experts are claiming these cases suggest there is a possibility of a new infectious polio-like syndrome in California, although they are telling people it is not an epidemic, and studies are underway to see if this is occurring in other states across the country. So on to our Oklahoma story. There has been a dramatic uptick in earthquakes shaking central Oklahoma this year, a continuing trend of unusually high earthquake activity all across the state, and it's leading scientists to speculate about a possible link to oil and gas production there, such as fracking. The U.S. Geological Survey found that from 1975 to 2008, central Oklahoma experienced 1 to 3 3-point magnitude earthquakes a year, compared with an average of 40 per year from 2009 to 2013. Well, this is 2014. It's only February, and the state has already logged more than 25 quakes of 3.0 magnitude or larger, and more than 150 total quakes in the past week alone. Wow.
Wow.
So that is, it's really been, that's really remarkable. That should raise eyebrows. Well, South Carolina City has implements a new law that requires a $120 permit to feed homeless people.
What?
The Examiner newspaper is reporting that, and I'm quoting, "Feeding the homeless is about to get harder as a new policy is set to begin this Saturday, February 15th in Columbia, South Carolina. Charities and nonprofits will be required to pay a fee and obtain a permit 15 days in advance in order to feed the homeless in parks. One impacted charity that was interviewed, Food Not Bombs, has been serving food to the homeless in Finlay Park every Sunday for 12 years. The group's organizer noted that the group has an impeccable track record and always tidies up after the meal. But with the new crackdown, Food Not Bombs will have to pay at least $120 per week for the right to feed the homeless. Since the Columbia City Council approved its exile plan in August, the city has been trying to herd its homeless people to a shelter on the outskirts of town and keep them away from the downtown area. If charities continue to provide food in downtown parks, the thinking goes, it will allow homeless people to continue to live downtown rather than being forced out of the downtown area. Well, privacy-enhanced phones are now really on the rise. They're getting pitched to mass-market consumers. You know, following the Snowden snooping revelations, there is a growing interest in a range of mobile phone products that will have privacy. And the latest contender is the Black Phone, which runs on a customized version of Google's Android software, and it encrypts texts, voice calls, and video chats. Now, it aims to tap into this growing market for the so-called mobile security management products, which is estimated to be worth at least $560 million and expected to double in size to over $1 billion by 2015. Everybody wants their privacy, understandably. Well, Apple has a problem for all of you Macintosh Apple lovers out there, and there's a lot of them. Friday, Apple quietly released iOS 7.06. It's a patch. And they explained in a brief release that it fixed a bug in which an attacker with a privileged network position may capture or modify data in sessions protected by SSL and TLS. Well, all of the geeks and the computer wizards out there are really upset. They're saying you better update your iPhone right now. And they say that OS X has the same issues, except there's no patch or fix for that yet. So what is SSL? Well, some of you may not know that SSL stands for Secure Sockets Layers, and it's what helps ensure that your communication between your browser and your favorite servers remain private and secure. Now, the TLS is called Transport Layer Security. It's a more recent protocol that does about the same thing. And in brief, SSL and TLS is a cryptographic key that lets a browser and a server know that they are who they say they are. They call it the secret digital handshake. Well, what's the bottom line about that? It keeps your financial information safe when you make an Amazon payment or when you log into your bank. And this also prevents what they call the man-in-the-middle attack. Well, the man-in-the-middle attack is kind of what people are really concerned about, which is basically high-tech eavesdropping. In this case, a man-in-the-middle attack on a shared network will intercept the communication between your browser and any site that you're on, that you're monitoring, recording. It sees everything that transpires between you and the site or the person or the thing that you're doing on your phone or on, you know, it's watching you. Now, normally attacks like this are prevented by the SSL-TLS encryption, but because the Apple phone had a bug in it, it makes this kind of spying incredibly easy. And this has been going on since September of 2012.
Oh, my.
So the experts are saying if you're on an iOS device, you need to download 7.0.6 immediately. If you've got a 3GS or an old iPod Touch, you can download iOS 6.1.6 instead. And if you were looking for an indication of just how seriously Apple is taking this, the fact that they're supporting an iOS version that they are incredibly eager to phase out should be as good an indicator as any. Now, if you are on OS X, you're out of luck. They say the vulnerability is still there, and now that this has been widely publicized, they say the bad guys are going to be keen to take advantage of it while they can. They say be sure to use Chrome or Firefox, which aren't affected on OS X. And they say make sure you stay on secured networks, and if you wind up on a secure on a shared network, play it smart. Don't give any financial info, no transactions, and no personal details. So that's news for the Starseed in the techie department. And so I think a lot of our listeners will relate to that. Some of you may have these versions or these particular devices, and I wanted to bring that to your attention. Well, New Mexico begins training cops to use more deadly force. This is news out of New Mexico. They say that all new police cadets will be trained to use more deadly force because of a new curriculum by a new director of a state's law enforcement academy. They say that this man named Jack Jones, who is a retired Army colonel, was granted sole authority over the training curriculum given to all of New Mexico's recruits. And when journalists filed a request for a copy of the academy's new curriculum, the director refused, saying it would give criminals an edge. He said, "I'll burn them before you get them," he told this to the New Mexican. Well, his new training program, which began January 20th, has been shortened from 22 weeks down to 16 weeks, leaving many people questioning what skills are being dropped from the curriculum while more deadly force is being added. Well, there's an advantage to getting older. There is a new study out, this was published on SciBlog, about how aging changes what makes you happy. And Thomas Wolfe said, "We are the sum of all the moments of our lives. All that is ours is in them." Well, this new study finds out that with increasing age, people get more pleasure out of everyday experiences, while younger people define themselves more by extraordinary experiences. Well, as a spiritual teacher, I can tell you that is absolutely true. Young people want punch in their lives. They want excitement in order to be happy. Well, you know, happy extraordinary experiences. Let's talk about happy extraordinary experiences. That might be like a trip to the Bahamas or maybe to Egypt or some cool place far away. These things happen less frequently, while ordinary happy experiences like seeing your family or being with your dog, well, they're much more common. But across all the age groups in the study, people found pleasure in all sorts of experiences, both ordinary and extraordinary, of course. They enjoyed their hobbies. They liked to be in nature. They liked to travel. They loved food. They loved to be in love, and they liked to just relax. But it was older people who managed to extract more pleasure from the ordinary stuff in life. And as an older person, I can tell you, yes, that's true. Older people get more pleasure out of spending time with their family from the look on someone's face or just having a stroll in the park. Now, younger people, in contrast, are more interested in defining themselves through extraordinary experiences. I find this to be extraordinarily true. The study says that young people actively look to define themselves. This is important. Listen to this. Young people actively look to define themselves and thus find it particularly rewarding to accumulate extraordinary experiences that mark their progression through life milestones and help them build an interesting experiential CV, or what? Curriculum vitae. So I have a comment about that in a moment, but I'll finish the story. Further experiments suggested that the focus on ordinary versus extraordinary is influenced by how much of life is still to come. Ordinary, mundane moments that make up everyday life tend to be overlooked when the future seems boundless. However, the potential for these ordinary experiences to contribute to happiness increases as people come to realize their days are numbered. These findings underline the importance of savoring experiences. Some of life's greatest moments are over in a flash, often with very little fanfare and almost no reflection. So we need to learn to savor life's little moments, even the little ones, because this is a skill that takes practice, and it does. This is where I'm going to lead into my little spiel here about when we're on the spiritual path, often we want the big experiences. We want the sensational things. We do tend, our young people generally do tend to want to build a profile because why? We have been trained by society to think in an academic or a business or a goal-oriented fashion. We think of spirituality as something that we're going to achieve, that it is something we're going to have sort of a medal of honor when we gain a certain level of understanding. Well, I'm here to say, dear friends, that life is not about that. Our everyday world is about that, perhaps, when we have to get a job or compile a resume or achieve certain financial goals. But when it comes to life itself, which is an organic consciousness, everything has its pace, everything has its cycle, and we need to become, in the spiritual path, we need to become connected to the fact that our consciousness goes through cycles, that it is a living thing, that we are alive, and that the purpose is not the destination, but it is about the journey itself. So too many people in this world are looking for the good stuff to come or reaching out for something that they want to have for an achievement, including spiritual progression, when I'm here to tell you that it happens every moment of every day. We need to appreciate the small things because that activates the heart chakra, which opens up our love connection, which puts us in alignment with the divine, and that's how we really find ourselves. That is the way we really can define ourselves. Everything else is pretty temporary. So that's it for tonight's news.
Well, that was very well said, and it's definitely thoughts to ponder. I know that, yeah, staying in the present moment and trying to stay holding your frequency at the highest level, just moment to moment, even if you're doing the dishes, you know.
Exactly.
And
that's really a hard message to get across to seekers, but that is the truth. It's really that simple. We tend to think that it can't be that simple, but it really is that simple. And yet, as you can testify, Ariel, it's not always that easy, right?
Well,
maybe simple,
no,
but it's
but,
not necessarily
know,
easy.
I don't know if you remember this, but there was a thing, a weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
Yeah.
You remember that toy?
Yeah.
You hit it and hit it, and it might wobble over, but it just won't fall down. It's, you know, it
yeah.
will regain balance. So, you know, I kind of use that analogy. Well, thank
one.
You so much for the news this evening, Anastasia. And we have our guest online. So we'll see you next week with more Starseed news, and thank you so much. So we are going to bring Normandy on at this moment as soon as the mic opens up. Hello, Normandy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're really looking forward to sharing your experiences, your insights, and learning. You have so many hats that you wear that I'm sure that you have a lot to bring to our audience. And we have a very awake audience, and I know they're just going to love what you have to say. So, Lavendar, you want to kick it off?
Yes, Normandy. So glad to have you.
Thank you. It's really good to speak with both of you.
Well, great. I've been to Egypt twice, back in the once in 81 and then in 83. And so much has happened since I have been there. But I noticed that you have been taking lots of people there. You're going in November on your 7th or 8th trip to Egypt. When did you become fascinated with Egypt?
Oh, gosh, let's see. I actually became fascinated with Egypt back when I was, I guess I had just graduated from getting my undergraduate degree, and I ran into a friend who was a Rosicrucian. And this friend and I had been reading a lot of Dion Fortune at the time and Colin Wilson and really started becoming interested in theosophy. And my friend, a Rosicrucian, had been taught to assist souls in transition when he was a medic in Vietnam. And so we began to have these conversations. And when he went out of town, he left his manuscript and books and stuff that he had with me and said he would come back for them. Well, to make a long story short, he did not come back for them. He died. And so the books became, in my possession, became sort of loaded, you might say. He had gotten me interested in reading the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I had bought the Wallace Budge version at his insistence. And then in graduate school, I started a translation project. And because in my younger years, I never knew whether I wanted to write or to paint, hieroglyphs kind of seemed a natural connection. And so in graduate school, I picked up hieroglyphs and decided I would teach myself how to read and write them. And so I took that Budge book and started translating it from beginning to end. and fell in love with the manuscript, fell in love with Egypt. It was like a 10-year love affair where I would wake up every morning at 4 in the morning and write for 4 hours before I went to work and really learned how to kind of explode the text. And that book became Awakening Osiris. And that sort of set me on the course. Gene Houston bought the rights to read it on audio version, and then I went to Egypt with her, and that sort of just started the whole thing. That was back in, graduate school was 1980, and then the book came out in 88. So.
Okay. So now you travel with Nikki Scully often, and
yes.
You've also worked with Gene Houston. And how did that come about?
Well, working with Gene was basically I was funny. She bought the rights to read Awakening Osiris on audio, and you know, at first I thought, well, that's an odd choice since she has her own books and she's so very famous, you know. But I thought, well, I should go and sit in on one of Gene's workshops. So I did, and when I met her, she was the most warm, genuine, welcoming person. She threw her arms around me and said, "Oh, lady, I've just been reading your book," and just, you know, welcomed me in. And so I have worked with her for a number of years, sometimes more closely than other times. And then with Nikki, this was like 1994. It was a cold call. And I got a call from this woman. My daughter answered the phone, and she asked for Normandy Ellis. And so my daughter holds the phone and says, "Hey, Mom, it's one of them." So anyway, that meant because she couldn't pronounce my name. So it's like, oh, okay. But afterwards, Nikki and I became fast friends, and I've gone to do Egyptian Mystery School at her retreat center in Oregon for 20 years, and we've been doing trips. I can't even remember when we started doing the first one, but yeah, we have another one in November. So she's a great, great friend.
So tell us a little bit about your experiences that you had in Egypt, something that our audience would really gravitate to, like the Wheel of Bardo. Can you explain more about the Wheel of Bardo and the Book of the Dead?
Well, I think that one of the things that the questions I always get are how connected is the Egyptian Book of the Dead with the Tibetan Book of the Dead? And my answer is that they are very connected, but they're two different traditions. So the process is that they talk about, each of them talk about it in a different way, but they attain the same thing. They attain the same kind of understanding. And I think the most important thing about either Book of the Dead is that it's something that you need to learn and apprehend while you're alive on this side. So that was, it was considered by the scribes to be the greatest profit for a scribe to be engaged in writing the Book of the Dead for someone else, you know, as their vocation, because they were constantly getting to know and understand the types of beings that they would meet in the other world and the prayers and petitions. They were constantly looking at their own lives and trying to make that life enlightened, and to basically engage in a kind of alchemy that turned the lead into gold. You know, like if we're looking for the philosopher's stone, the truth is that we are the philosopher's stone. You know, it's the transmutation of our own darkness into the goldenness that this whole thing is about. And I think both Books of the Dead try to attain that, you know, through the naming of the various shadows and the things that we must go through in life as well as in death. In terms of experiences that I've loved, one of the most potent things that ever happened to me was in 2009, I took my mother's ashes to the Temple of Isis. And there on the island of Philae, you know, let her go. And there were a lot of us who were letting people go that we loved. And then we sat on the wall and watched the sun come up as the herons, you know, were gliding across the water. It was a very beautiful, a very peaceful, a very quiet and loving send-off. It was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So on the many trips that you've taken, have you seen any extraterrestrial ships in the air, any UFOs?
Well, I have not. I have seen some video of folks who have seen some recently, apparently. But, of course, one always wonders what you see, you know, on a YouTube video. However, from personal experience, I will say that I was in Saqqara with a group Nikki and I had taken. And we were leading a meditation to raise the energy and sort of create a cone of light for some dark places on the earth at that time. I think Milosevic was one of the ones that I remember thinking, okay, we really need to send a cone of light there. You know, there were other places that were in dire need at the time. And so as we were meditating and feeling this energy, I mean, I just started chanting and I could feel this wave of energy and this heat that was coming up. And I mean, most everybody at that point had their eyes closed. I opened my eyes and we're in this sort of depression inside the sand, and up on the rim of the sand, of a sand dune, there were 18 beings of light, very tall, very brilliant. They looked like flames themselves, and they were watching us. And I just sort of like saw this out of the corner of my eye and just had to close my eyes again and kept going, because it was like, you know, you don't want to lose where you are. And so then after we closed the meditation, and there was a young boy who was among other people holding camels for us to ride back to the bus. And so I'm kind of gathering up the things around the group, you know, the objects that we had in front of us, the crystals and so on. And as I'm gathering them, this boy comes to me and he says, "Who were they?" And I said, "Oh, what do you mean, the people who were with me, the group?" And he points to the rim above where I had seen the individual. He goes, "No, who were they?" So he had seen them too. And I said, "Well, I believe they are who you think they are." And he was like, "Okay." It was pretty intense, you know. That was an amazing experience.
So have you been able to spend the night in the Great Pyramid?
Oh, yes, several times. Several times. We usually spend at least 2 or 3 hours, but I did spend one lovely all night inside the Great Pyramid. And when I was with Jean Houston's group, I walked out exactly at the moment of sunrise. And I don't think I've ever felt so light-filled, you know, to be standing at the entrance of the Great Pyramid and have the sun, you know, just like cresting that hill and shooting straight into my heart. And it was very dizzying. You know, I went outside and I could barely stand up, because having been inside that sarcophagus, it's like, you know, it's like having a sound massage. You can feel these waves, the vibrations like going back and forth across your body, you know, sloshing sort of almost, you know, as one vibration hits the end of the sarcophagus and then rebounds coming back and another one comes down. And it's just this very intense web of energy that you're inside. So when I came out, I needed to get sort of grounded, you know, literally. So I walked out behind the pyramid and laid down in the sand. And, of course, all that sand is like a crystalline structure. So it's by itself. It's still, you're in that energy field. And I remember lying there and watching at sunrise, the birds were going crazy in the light. They would circle round and around and around one of the pyramids, starting at the base, and then they would make these spirals that would go up and up, top of the cone of the pyramid, and then when they reached the top, they would shoot off to the next pyramid and then spiral down, you know, to the ground, and then kind of reverse it and go back up, spiral up and up and up and up until they got to the top and shoot off to the third one. It was really wild. You know, it was like they were so trippy, feeling that energy vibration that they were, you know, and those pyramids were so, you know, lively, I guess. It was a wonderful thing to see. It was very beautiful.
I too experienced coming out of the Great Pyramid and just at the moment of the rising of the sun, so I know exactly what you're talking about. It's just probably one of the deepest memories that I'll ever have. It's one that stays with you no matter where you go in life. Just close your eyes and remember that moment. Yeah, that was really something. I noticed that you talked about netters. Can you explain what a netter is to our audience?
Right. The Netaru are all of the gods and goddesses of Egypt. And, of course, there are many. You know, the Christians said all those pagans, they had, you know, too many gods and goddesses. Well, basically, a Netter is, the hieroglyphic word is N-T-R. So it's also like in the Greek it became Netcher, N-E-T-J-C-H-E-R. And then the Greeks took these divine beings that were in all the animals and the plants and the air and the sand and the water and, you know, every element of life. And they used that word nature and called it nature, you know. And so the natural world is the godded world in ancient Egypt. And I really think that, you know, a lot of fundamentalist Christians get it wrong when they think that you know, you're talking about the sun god and you're talking that sounds pagan. But really you're talking about the divine light that is in the sun, but that divine light is in everything. And there's this, actually this 14th century, I think he was 14th century Christian, whose name was Meister Eckhart. And he said this great thing. He said, apprehend God in all things, for God is in all things. Every single creature is filled with God and is a book about God. And I just love the idea that it's a whole book, you know, so that the hymns that we write, you know, to the hymn to Nuit, the sky goddess, you know, the night sky, it, you know, that's the godded world. And that it's just so beautiful to think that everything that we touch is filled with that spark. And the Egyptians knew that so well. They never forgot it.
Can you tell us about some of the experiences that you had while traveling through Egypt about these netters coming alive and experiencing them?
Well, on a most recent trip, I have to say, was one of my favorite trips. It was in November. And it was during a full moon, and it was a Halloween full moon, so it was a Scorpio full moon, and it was beautiful, and it was intense, and it was so large coming up over the sand dunes with just this palm tree behind it, and it was amazing. We took a picture of it. When I looked at it later, it looked like a skull. It was so great, but it was the god Thoth, and it was so, you know, he appears as the moon god. He has this, the reflection in the water, and so, you know, we were playing music on the boat that night and dancing, and I looked into the water over the boat, and I could see that the waves of music were creating waves on the water, and the moonlight became this rapid, incredible script, like a hieroglyphic script. And I was watching it, and, you know, other people began to gather and look over the side of the boat, and it truly looked as if the god Thoth, the god of scribes, the moon god, was riding in the water with this music. It was so incredible and amazing. And we did videotape it for about 15 minutes, I think. And I'm going to give myself the task in the future of trying to transcribe those writings in the water. But it became, what happened after that is that that sparked this whole creative outpouring. When I got back from Egypt, I suddenly was writing a poem every single day. I would wake up and it would be there. And it's my newest book. It's called Words on Water, and it's published by Finishing Line Press, and it's all about the sacred marriage between the sky goddess and the earth god, between Hathor, the goddess of love and beauty, and Horus, the hero god. So all of these poems kind of center around the night that that moon wrote in the water, you know, with the pen of Thoth.
Wow. I can just visualize that as you're talking. You've been very, very involved with hieroglyphic language. Tell us more about what you think the terms are of thought, symbol, and sound, and so forth of hieroglyphics. And when you see a hieroglyphic, is it like a word, or is it like 30 volumes into one symbol?
That's a good way of putting it. It's like 30 volumes, yeah. Well, when I was translating the hieroglyphs, I mean, I was trained mostly as a writer, so and it was in graduate school, not in Egyptology, but in creative writing. So I came upon the hieroglyphs kind of in a roundabout way, and I must say that learning how to read hieroglyphs taught me everything about how to become a writer, because I saw that it was working on three different levels. You have this image on a piece of paper, and the image itself becomes a symbol. You know, if you have there are 356 different birds, you know, in the hieroglyphic repertoire. But a bird with his wing up over his head, it is linked to the god Thoth and to the ibis, who lifts his wing up over top of the water and creates a shadow, and it's when he looks into the shadows of the river that he's able to see the fish that he wants. And so, like, you know, you have to learn a few things about the symbol, and then you begin to say, oh, well, that hieroglyph is symbolic of discernment. It's teaching us how to look into the depths of something, which exactly is what Thoth teaches us to do, you know, because he's the god of magic and mystery. It's also, the hieroglyphs are phonetic, and they're not written with vowels by and large. It's kind of like the Hebrew language where the vowels are sacred. You know, in the Hebrew language, they're written in the flames above the actual consonants. And in the hieroglyphs, many of them are implied. So you have to like play with, sometimes there's like this sort of punning that goes on in some of the language. Okay, and for example, like there's the hieroglyph of the dung beetle that means transformation, but it also means to create, to be, to become, to begin. I mean, it just depends on how it's used in what other sounds accompany it. So when you look at the hieroglyphic translation that has the dung beetle in it, it would say something like, Nukpu im kepera, kepere, keperu, Nukpu im rea. And so all those kepers in a row. So I translated it as meaning, in the beginning, I became the becoming, being what I created. So there's kind of like this pun, and it's sort of like the idea of the language rolling along. And that's something that You know, you want to play with sound and image when you're working in poetry. And then the other thing is that in the hieroglyphs, everything is an embedded myth. You know, you don't anywhere get the full mythology of this story, you know, or that story. It's, you learn it in bits and pieces through the different glyphs. And so when I was translating, I had to figure out that the story and the sound of a piece and the image all worked, had to work together. And, you know, if you translate a word like heka as magic, which is what it means, you don't really get the imagery of the H sound, which is like a braided wick for a candle flame, and the ka sound, which is the two arms open so that the chest is exposed and they're uplifted in an attitude of prayer. And then you have another hieroglyph that's a rolled up scroll tied with a red string. And then you have three seeds after it. And that's the word for magic. But all of that implies, you know, it's this passionate pronouncement from this sacred text that opens up the heart and the spirit, and it plants a seed for transformation and becoming. Well, you could say it's magic, you know, or you could call it a word of power, or you could call it what Wallace Budge called it, which was effective utterance. But none of that really gets to what those images are doing, you know, so you kind of have to play with the hieroglyphs and explore them in a little bit of a different way when you're trying to do a translation from the inside out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. What are some of your favorite chapters in the Book of the Dead? And I understand that you translated a lot of them in your book.
Right. I used the Papyrus of Ani. And he was a scribe, like back in the New Kingdom, who taught other scribes how to write the Book of the Dead. So he had access to every single chapter. So his own book has just about every single chapter of the Book of the Dead that exists. And I would say some of my favorite pieces from that are the becoming pieces or the transformation pieces. Where you use your active imagination to become the divine quality of something else. Like you become a hawk divine, you become the crocodile, you become the snake, you become a swallow, and I think all, you become a hawk, you know, all of those things, you become a lotus. All of those things, it's possible for us to see the godness in them. Like the lotus itself is the god Nefertum, but in another life we can become like Nefertum, that child that, you know, rises from the muck and blossoms into light, you know, with a new dawn. So I would say the becoming pieces are some of my favorites. A truly one of my very favorites is a really, really short one. Some of the hymns in the back of the piece, the hymn to Hathor. And if you don't mind, I'll just say it like real, just a moment, because it's fairly brief, and then I want to tell you a little bit about that one. Okay, it goes like this. Blue-lidded daughter of dawn, golden Lady of the mountain, carrier of her father's wisdom, let an old one rest in your arms. Let him look last on love's face, breathing love's breath. I live in light a million years. The sun rises or sets now, it matters not. Here is ecstasy in death and certainty in life. We are gods in the body of God. Truth and love are destiny. Go and make of the world something beautiful. Set up a light in the darkness. And that's the last hymn in Awakening Osiris, the hymn to Hathor, who is considered the Lady of the West. And that one means so much to me because so many of the people that I have known who have had loved ones in transition have used that particular hymn as part of their ceremony to send the other person on to the other side. And when I was in Egypt with Jean, I had a roommate, June Sampson, and her husband had Alzheimer's, and he was back in the States, and he died while she was there. And rather than go home, June stayed with the trip. And in every single temple where we went, she went into the Holy of Holies, and she recited that piece for her husband, Edgar. And now June is passed into spirit now, but that means a lot to me that it was used that way.
That's really beautiful. Yeah, that really touches me. I need to ask you a question about emerald stones or the green scarabs or any of those things. Did you find a trail of intrigue with, say, the emerald beetles or the scarabs?
Now, how do you mean a trail of intrigue? Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, it's you know, from my observation and things that I've been tracking, it's like the high priestess of the different times would always seem to carry a green stone. I found that to be something that they all had in common, an emerald or a green scarab.
Malachite was probably the stone of, most often used. And, of course, malachite is a stone of abundance for the green color. It's the stone of transformation. It's the color of the heart chakra in ancient Egypt because those scarabs were placed over top of the heart, and on the back of them was written an incantation for the person to say when their heart is being weighed in the balance in the underworld. And the heart is like the essential record, the Akashic record of everything is kept in the heart. It's not, they throw the brains away. It doesn't mean anything, but the heart is the true record of our life's existence.
Right.
And so I would say that green stone is a reminder of how everything that we say or do or think is written in that stone. And I would say carrying it and then having it carved, when you make your crossing, the stone would be magically charged because of that.
Okay, good. Can you walk us through what happens on one of your trips? Can you take us, give us 2 or 3 days of activities, and then also mention how people can get in touch with you if they want to go on a trip?
Okay, sure. The first thing we usually do is we arrive in Cairo and we stay at the Mena House. The Mena House was built by one of the early French architects right on the Giza Plateau. And so it overlooks the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. And we'll go in the morning, first thing in the morning, we have special permission to stand between the paws of the Sphinx and open the portal and greet the sun and sort of prepare ourselves for the download of the trip. Then we often go to Saqqara, which is nearby, near Giza. It is the site of many of the old kingdom, the earliest pyramid, the step pyramid that Imhotep built, the festival court, the Hebsed court of the pharaoh Zoser, and many of the other pharaohs. Every pharaoh used that. The very earliest hieroglyphic text appears at Saqqara, inside the Pyramid of Unas, and it's like the world's oldest prayer book written in stone on the walls. If we're lucky, we get to go inside that pyramid. There are other pyramids that have similar text, so if you don't get in there, you get to see it at least other places. And the Serapeum, which is the hall where the bulls were buried, that it's really quite fantastic. Then we'll get into an airplane and fly to Luxor. So when we get off in Luxor, Luxor is kind of like where nearly everything happens. You can go in and out of a number of places from Luxor. We'll get onto a boat, the Afandina, that's a two-mast dahabiya, and that's our home for the next 10 days. We sleep on the boat. We eat on the boat. We have a private chef. We have our meals under a cabana, sometimes in the middle of an island. They'll carry the chairs and stuff out. We'll have lunch there. It's you know, it has its own deck and stuff where we spend a lot of time riding and preparing ourselves and holding classes on that particular boat. So from that boat, we go to the, Karnak and to the temple of Ptah to see the lion goddess Sekhmet, who is there. With any luck, we'll get to go there. We go to the temple of Luxor, which is also called the Temple of Man, and it's a temple that's built in divine human proportions. We go to the Temple of Hatshepsut. We go to the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens. From there, we get on a bus and we'll travel to Dendera, which is my favorite place in the world. That's the temple to the goddess Hathor. And then we'll go to Abydos, which is dedicated to Osiris. Well, to nine different gods from the Pharaoh Seti, and it was written about by Jonathan Cott when he wrote the book Om Seti. This is the temple that Om Seti she took care of that temple for years because she believed that she had been the lover of Seti the First in a previous life. And so when she was 90, she died there, but that it's a very strong, very powerful temple, one of the oldest. We'll see the flower of life at the temple of Abydos. We go to, I'm trying to think, what am I leaving out? There's another one. There are a couple of other ones like Medinet Habu and so on, which we sometimes go to, the Colossi of Memnon, and all of that's accessible from Luxor. And then when we get in the boat, we sail upstream. We'll go to, I'm trying to remember in order how we do it. Esna is a temple dedicated to the crocodile god Khnum and to the goddess Neith. And, the crocodile god, sorry, Sobek, to the ram-headed god Khnum and to the goddess Neith. And she's a weaver. And so this town, interestingly enough, is where you buy the best textiles in Egypt, is at Esna. We'll go to Edfu, which is the home of the hawk god Horus, and it's probably the most complete temple in all of Egypt that you'll ever see, with the inner and outer walls and all of the rooms that are, you know, connected to it, chambers above and chambers below. And we'll go to Komombo, which is a dual temple that has two aisles, two channels, two holy of holies. One side's dedicated to the crocodile god Sobek, and the other side is dedicated to Horus, the hawk god. And now that's really interesting because it is so close to the river. It's practically on the river itself. And when you walk to the back of the temple, you can see that the desert is about to encroach upon the temple. You can see dunes right up above the temple walls. So literally, you are in a spot where you could probably stand with one foot on the green earth and one foot in the sand. You are so close to, you know, life and death. And that really is what that temple is about, with the crocodile god and the hawk god. And then we go to see the temple of Kunum at Elephantine on the island. And we see the goddess Satis there and the goddess Unket. We walk up through these excavations that have been ongoing, or we have in the last few years. And you can see, you can kind of look back and see where there were villages, you know, temples built upon top of temples, on top of temples, on top of temples. And, you know, you can see one temple literally sitting on the roof of another temple. And then over on the other side where there's an Egyptian temple to the god Khnum, who made people out of clay on his potter's wheel, there's a similar temple to a god Yahweh who made people out of clay, you know, that the Hebrew community who helped, you know, run part of Aswan during the Olden and Middle Kingdoms. And this would have been probably before Exodus. So it's kind of interesting to see that history there. We go on a boat and go to the Temple of Isis, which is above the Aswan Dam. And we usually go in the morning, in the quiet, in the dark, before sunrise, no talking. We travel the way that the old priestesses traveled to the Temple of Silence. And then we go into the Holy of Holies in the dark, and we say our prayers there. And then we go and sit on a wall overlooking the lake and watch the sunrise. It's very quiet, very peaceful. And after the sun rises, you can see the old temple to Osiris that was across from the temple of Isis, where she would go, the priestesses would go every morning and make their petitions there. And then that takes us to the time where we get on the airplane and go back into Cairo. We go to the Khan el Khalili Bazaar. We go into some of the mosques. We go into Old Cairo, where you can see synagogues and temples and Coptic churches side by side. And then the last thing that we do is we go inside the Great Pyramid and have an initiation inside the Great Pyramid, where each person goes into the sarcophagus for a period of time.
And wow, what a trip. Woo! How many days is this?
It's 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks.
And
yeah,
what are the dates in November?
The
what dates are they
November
in November?
9th, November 9th to the 23rd.
So you'll be there on Pleiadian lineup.
We will.
Yeah.
We will.
Yeah,
we sure
when
will.
When the sun rises with the Pleiades, yeah.
We sure will.
Well, I was there on a full moon in Scorpio on November 17th, 18th, and 19th in 1983, and it was quite a trip. It was really something to behold, but just listening to you, and I was kind of following along because I had been to all those places that you just mentioned. And
right.
My question was, what kind of airplane flies? The little small airplane?
Oh, yeah. It's not that small, actually. It's an hour flight, but it's a regular-sized commercial airplane.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I took the
yeah.
train before. I took the train from Cairo down to
Yeah, we did that once before, but we lose less time this way.
Yeah, I understand. And I love the idea of staying on the boat. That's really cool.
Oh, it is. It's so great. I do love that so much.
So how many do you take on the trip?
Well, the boat only holds 18 people, so it's a small boat, and it feels pretty fast. You know, when we do double occupancy, so I think that you share a bath, you know, with your roommate. But it's pretty cozy, actually. And very nice. The food is fabulous. The chef, my goodness, he, you know, if you're allergic to fish or you're allergic to eggs or you can't do gluten, whatever, he does it. You know, he can figure out how to cook for anybody, and he will make what you need for your dinner, lunch, breakfast, whatever. It's really good.
That's great. You know, when we were in Egypt, we were there when Reagan got shot, and I was told to go inside the pyramid and find 18 people. It's funny you mentioned 18, and to take them, give them crystals, and we did something called taking the press secretary. I can't remember his name right now.
James Brady.
Brady, there we go. We had heard that Brady had died, and so we were going to take him through Bardo. And at the moment that we were taking him through Bardo, we found out later that in New York, where he was in surgery, that there was this blue light that came down over his body at the exact same time as we were taking him through Bardo.
Wow.
There was 18 of us inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. And, of course, the Germans and the French were all upset because they had closed off the pyramid for us and wouldn't
right.
let anybody else in, and
right.
really created a disturbance. But 18, yeah, and I had these 18 crystals that had been given to me earlier saying, save these, because one day you'll need 18 of them. So when you said 18 beings were standing up, you know, on the ledge, and then 18, that's a very special number for apparently the initiation of what we do on the planet.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, if you're interested in numerology, 8 plus 1 is 9, and the 9 is a 3 times 3 cycle. So in the ancient Egyptian, there were 9 great gods and goddesses. They were called the Aeneid. And so that number connects to them.
Yeah, right. And the Council of
yeah.
9. Yeah, all of it.
And the Council of 9, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Just sounds like a wonderful experience that you have every time that you go. So why don't you tell people how to contact you if they're interested in going on this trip. Are you full already, or do you still have openings?
No, we're not full already. We're about halfway full.
Okay.
And if you're interested, the place to register for the trip or to get more information is www.shamanicjourneys.com. And that's Nikki Scully's website. And you just click on the travel link, and our trip will come right up.
Okay.
And if they're if they just have questions and they just want to know more information, they can email me at ellisisis@gmail.com.
Okay. Okay, great. Do you also do Akashic readings for people?
I do Akashic records consultations. Yes, I do.
And they can find that on your website also?
That's right. They can find that on my website, right? Or just email me again.
Okay.
And pretty easy.
Okay, great. So at this time, I'm going to turn this over to Ariel, our co-host, and I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you well on your trip to Egypt. Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You. It's been great talking to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we have people on the switchboard, and if anyone would have a comment or question for Normandy, you're going to have to press 1 so we know you want to come on the air. So while we are waiting for that process to happen, I would like to just ask you, I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as you and Lavendar about, I mean, Egyptian history, but it kept occurring to me while you were talking, it's like, was this an evolution of thought and understanding, or were these ancient Egyptians inspired and given this information, you know, from higher dimensional beings?
Ariel, that's a great question. You know, it really is. And it's one that people have just been trying to figure this out for the longest time. What's so amazing is that when the hieroglyphs appear inside the Pyramid of Unas. This is like around 2600 BC. They're full-blown. They don't look to be like they're developing. They are already created and given. So, you know, somehow they must have either come from somewhere else, you know, or that they were developing over a period of time and we've just lost the record of that. I kind of feel that they came from somewhere else. And the reason I say that is that when you have a language that's that strongly symbolic, as the hieroglyphs are, I think that it speaks to trying to use the symbol and the image to transcend any kind of language barrier. But the hieroglyphs also, the words, the letters, the vowels, everything, they're vibrationally interesting. And they work not only as meaning, but they work as intonation. You know, in the same way that in Sanskrit you can intone the om and over a sand, and I believe the guy's name is called Symetics. And Hans Jenny proved that if you chant om over top of a tray of sand, it creates the glyph of om in the sand, you know, the
wow.
vibration, the sound. And this, you know, and I think the hieroglyphs work the same way. I think the knowledge of the fact that there are particular kinds of stones, like the granite that the pyramid is built out of, that hold resonance and vibration. I really think that this is all very complex information, and we're only just now looking at things in terms of physics to begin to understand what the ancient Egyptians seem to have already known all along.
Right.
So there are a lot of people who believe that the information came from outside us and was given to us as part of our growth. The Egyptians themselves say that the people who are their ancestors came from the Pleiades, or from Sirius. You know, Isis is connected to Sirius and the Dog Star, and the Dogon tribes of Africa already knew that, you know, there was a Sirius A and a Sirius B. They understood that it was a binary planet. Well, they couldn't see that with telescopes, but the Dogons knew it because they said that's where their people came from the Dog Star. So it's like, if you can't prove it, but it sure points to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you can't disprove it either. And,
that's
you
right.
know, the we've had other guests with other areas of expertise, but one in particular, James Gilliland, who has a lot of experience with the feline race, which are, you know, extraterrestrially based, but they've been involved in the Earth, and I think it's very possible when you see in, you know, in Egyptian drawings, beings that are like human cats.
Right, exactly.
You know, that can't be a coincidence, you know, and the depiction of the elongated skulls, I mean, that's an extraterrestrial connection as well. So I would think that, as you do, that this came from beyond. It wasn't an evolution of science and understanding. It was just a interaction between the ancestors of the ancestors and the
right.
ancestors, uh-huh. But they had to be a spiritually at least developed to even be involved like that. I mean, there certainly were other pockets of humanity on the planet that weren't chosen it that way in that time. You know what I'm saying? The Egyptians
right,
had
I
to
do.
Together to be you know, even as a you know, an offspring kind of a colony of bloodline experiments from extraterrestrials, which is really where it gets interesting when you try to go beyond what you can prove with science and historical documents and put the whole puzzle together, which I think you're really doing well.
Well, there's the other thing I'll just sort of throw out there, which is that I'm of the suspicion that we make a mistake when we think that it's a development of a culture from beginning to end, because time is just relative to people who have been placed like in their little pod in this sequence. And when you move out into another dimension, you come back forward or backward into a sequence. And so, you know, sometimes I imagine that the Egypt that we think is so brilliant and how did we forget it is actually something that's part of what we're creating now, you know, with the consciousness that we're working on. And so that maybe we're dreaming them forward. Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm barely grasping that, but yeah. Yeah.
It's possible we could do that too. Yeah.
It is a timeless civilization. And what is the earliest indication of Egyptian civilization? I mean, it goes back before, you know, anybody ever wrote any history down.
Yeah, well, 10,000 BC is, I mean, they have artifacts that they have found at least that far back, certainly as far back as 6,000. And there are around 10,000 BC, you're beginning to have like those clay figurines and things that, you know, like the bird woman and some of those other images are much earlier than the written hieroglyphs. I would say 10,000 BC is not too far off. But you know, what's really interesting to me is that in the middle of the desert, of the Sahara Desert, there are these big humps of rock that the sand has finally scoured them down and revealed that these big hunks of rock are actually vestigial whales that got landlocked in the middle of the desert when it was, you know, a source of water. And here's the wild part. They have feet.
Oh, my God.
They have feet. They were getting ready to start walking. And then they got caught inside the desert. The water disappeared, and the sand covered them up. Yeah, is that not wild?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're like, yeah, 40,000 BC or something like that.
Wow. And so, yeah. And they were whales that were starting to evolve into land creatures.
They were turning into mammals. They were mammals that were growing feet. Yep.
Well, and certainly the whales are very strongly, you know, connected to other planets and other species.
Yes.
Even in today's world, this is just fascinating. Wow, I had no idea that a whale in the middle of the desert.
I know.
Wow.
Makes you think extra hard about Jonah, doesn't it?
Right. Gosh. Well, I'm going to ask one more time if anyone on the switchboard has a question or comment for Normandy. Just press 1 so that we know you want to come on the air. And I'll give a couple of more minutes, and you've covered everything really well. Oh, we do have, here we go. As soon as she gets out of the screening room, we'll have a caller with a question for you.
Okay.
So can you talk a little bit more about, you say you teach the Egyptian mysteries. Is that part of your trip where you mentioned classes? And
yeah, it is part of the trip. And I do a lot of I talk a lot about what's inside the Book of the Dead and how it was used, and we do a lot of writing of our own, you know, Book of the Dead. But then we also work with sort of alchemical transformations of, you know, like working with prayers and intention. I think last time we were at Kamombo, we worked to create sacred water while we were on the boat. And though we could not do ritual in front of the temple guards, that would have sort of been not too cool. We did it on the boat, and then we took our water bottle into the temple. And when no one was looking, we pour it into the well, into the sacred well, and say our prayers all together. You know, so it just sort of was kind of a quiet undercurrent of an initiation and a ritual that we were working with to, you know, bless the waters of the earth.
Well, it's not only an adventure, but it's a learning process and a giving back and doing.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we have some callers with questions now. So let's first we're going to be talking to Kat. Hello, Kat. You have a question for Norma?
Hi, Ariel.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I do. I was just wondering, I've been doing some research, but I was wondering the connection between Atlantis and the beginnings of Egypt and the mystery schools. Is there a connection there, or?
I think there is, and there are a lot of other people who believe that there is a connection between Atlantis and Egypt and Peru and India. And one of the things that I'll just say very quickly is to point you to a book by a couple of Canadians named Rand, like Randall, but it's R-A-N-D, and Rose, his wife, and their last name is Flemath. It's a hyphenated F-L-E-M hyphen A-P-H. They wrote this book called When the Sky Fell, and it's all about, boy, I heard y'all talking about the polar vortexes at the opening of the show, and I'm sitting here thinking, you know, this is about the last ice age, and when the polar ice caps melted, the weight of that shifted the polar axis. This is their theory, and that it was like all of a sudden that's what caused the woolly mammoths to have, you know, orange flowers inside their digestive canals when they were flash frozen, because the world just suddenly fell, you know, and places that had been savanna dried up, and places that had been, you know, like alpine meadow suddenly became under ice and so on. And that they noticed that from a Landsat satellite image that took infrared photography and looked at the land formations of Antarctica, they believed that they found that in fact, was Atlantis, because the dimensions are pretty much exactly what Plato had drawn as a map of Atlantis. And so the assumption is that the cultures sent their boats out and went to Peru and went to Egypt and went to India. And you can find boats that are sewn, you know, with the same, they're kind of like crafted with the exact same techniques in Lake Titicaca as well as in Egypt. They make them the exact same way and have for thousands of years. You know, so how do you do that? That's kind of interesting. Now, the guy who has done the most research on that, I would say, is probably Graham Hancock. And so I'd take a look at some of his books.
Okay. Great. Wow.
Yeah, that
was busy for a while. That's awesome. Yeah, because I've been trying to figure out the connection between Isis and the Aztecs and Atlantis and it's just really a lot of information out there, and a lot of it is just way too much to go through. So thank you very much for references. I will definitely check those out.
Oh, yeah, great.
Great. Well, thanks for calling, Kat.
Thank you so much. Have a good one. Blessings.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and let's see. It looks like we're going to be talking next to Allie. You have a question for Normandy? Hello?
Yes. Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can. Hi, Allie. How are you?
Yes, hello. I have a question that maybe fits in with some of what you've been talking about. You know, a lot of these ancestral peoples that have either disappeared.
Hello? Well, that's really strange. Well, you disappeared there for a moment.
Disappeared. Is he still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're okay.
Yes, I'm here. So the question is simple, really. What did the Egyptians leave us in the way of prophecies for the times that we're in now, especially concerning Egypt itself, for all the hardships it's going through now?
Oh, wow. I wish I knew. You know, I find myself going back and looking at texts that were in, like, the Emerald Tablet. The Emerald Tablet is probably the closest to something that has prophecies about that particular end times in terms of Egypt. It does not say anything about the particular political situation or the bloodshed. It talks in terms of environmental degradation that comes to pass, and then there is a period of time in which you'll know that the return has happened when, you know, the blue lotus comes again to the Nile, and when the heron comes back to fish on the bank. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that Emerald Tablet text tells us something about that. There are other traditions that may have been handed down to the Greeks who were studying with the ancient Egyptians. Now, the ancient Egyptians didn't write things down like that. The only thing that we have is from the Books of the Dead and some of the other records of, you know, like the pharaohs this or that, you know, some of the hymns, we have some of that stuff. But in terms of prophecies and their own history and literature, all of that was held very closely because they were considered part of the mystery tradition, and the mystery tradition was handed down mouth to ear. Okay, even when the ancient Egyptian priests were teaching in Alexandria, and they were teaching the Greeks, and they were teaching Hypatia about the depths of mathematics and astronomy, they would not let them write things down. They could only learn them orally because that was how the tradition was handed down. So it's kind of interesting when you ask that question. The only thing we have in terms of a record of that comes from the Greeks through the Emerald Tablet.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Thanks for calling, Ali. We got a little bit of weirdness on the line here. I think it's clearing up.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, well, like I said at the top of the show, three more days of Mercury retrograde, and it seems like this one in particular has affected electronics even more so than usual. Sometimes it's more about communication or something, but there's just been a little bit of technological weirdness, but we're almost through it now, thankfully.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I think we've covered all the callers with questions. So,
okay.
If there's anything you'd like to add before we wrap up, now would be the time, and Lavendar for you as well.
Okay, well, one thing I just want to say is that if for some reason people are not able to make the trip to Egypt, though I would love for them to make the trip to Egypt, Nikki and I are offering a mystery school in Indiana. We're doing it in the Midwest as opposed to in Oregon this year, and it's going to be May 8th to the 12th at Camp Chesterfield, Indiana, which is a spiritualist retreat center. That being that all the people who live here at the camp, including me, are quite accustomed to talking to people from the other side.
Yeah.
So, we're all mediums. So it should be a kind of a fun place to have an Egyptian mystery during May. So if you're interested in that, go ahead and check it out at shamanicjourneys.com or by emailing me.
Okay, and you're saying Shamanic Journeys, plural, with an S on the end, journeys?
Yes, with an X.
And your email is Ellis Isis, E-L-L-I-S, and then I-S-I-S. That goes together really well.
Yeah, I like it.
Ellis Isis at Gmail, you said?
Yes.
Gmail.com.
Right.
Okay, and of course, your main website where people can see all the books that you've written and pick their favorites is normandyellis.com, and that's spelled N-O-R-M-A-N-D-I, Ellis, E-L-L-I-S.com.
Right.
So, Normandy, it's just been a pleasure having you with us, and I want to thank you for the work that you're doing on the planet, empowering people and helping to raise vibrations where the light is needed. So we thank you for your work on the behalf of the planet and for joining us here this evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great, great talking with you. I appreciate it.
Well, same here. And we will be back next week, and we'd like to thank you all for listening this evening. Special thanks to Fiona and Anastasia, as well as from Lavendar and myself. We wish you all a great week, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.